boss, and they're really career civil servants who just want to do their jobs and want to see justice happen. And then there's this new kind of person who's appearing in government now, who comes out of the corporate defense sector. These are people who grew up as corporate lawyers defending companies like Chase and Bank of America, and that's who Eric Holder is. Very pointedly, he spent a long time at a company called Covington & Burling, and this type of lawyer, this type of law enforcement official, is much more interested in coming up with a settlement that everybody feels good about when they walk out of the room, as opposed to the old school kind of justice where the bad guy gets his or her comeuppance in the end. And I think his tenure was very representative of a big sea change in the way we do white-collar crime in this country.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us, Matt Taibbi. Again, we will link to your piece at Rolling Stone. It's called The $9 Billion Witness. Meet the woman, J.P. Morgan Chase, paid one of the largest fines in American history to keep from talking. And thank you to that woman, Elaine Fleischman. Thank you so much for joining us. Elaine Fleischman, the J.P. Morgan Chase whistleblower, former deal manager at J.P. Morgan, where she says she witnessed massive criminal securities fraud in the bank's mortgage operations during the period leading up to the financial crisis. And congratulations on your book coming out in paperback, Matt. Thanks so much, everyone, for being with us. Happy birthday to Karen Meadows. I'll be speaking in Princeton on Sunday. Check our website, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltzer.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. It is now 8 o'clock, actually 8:01. Stay tuned for Positively Revolting right after this.
Sing songs, it will prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot
In addition to being weird, Portland is becoming known in the tech industry as a city that fosters innovation. Many people working in the industry believe that new technology can solve problems, including social and environmental problems. Tune in this Friday at 11 a.m. for Disruptive Technologies and Human Design, Part 4 of Startup City, How the New Tech Boom is Changing Portland.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought, tell the world how you cast your vote.
Thank you. And good morning, good morning, good morning. You are listening to your community radio station, KBOO. It's 8:05 in the morning, and this is Positively Revolting. I'm your host, Ani, along with Lynn, your other host.
Good morning. Good morning. A good foggy fall. If this isn't a fall morning, we don't have one. There's all the beautiful jewel-toned trees going through the mist and the fog. It's kind of nice, and it's cold, but it's not that cold.
It's gorgeous. Mm-hmm. It really is. That all said, welcome to Positively Revolting. This morning we are talking about Rachel Corey. Rachel Corey is the young American woman who was killed by Israeli military forces in the Gaza Strip in 2003 while defending Palestinian housing. The play, My Name is Rachel Corey, will be performed this Sunday and is followed by a discussion with Rachel Corey's parents, Cindy and Craig Corey. And we are fortunate this morning to have Cindy and Craig with us by phone. Good morning, Cindy and Craig. Are you there?
Yes, we are.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us. For listeners that aren't familiar with Rachel Corey's story, let's start with a little background. Rachel was a student at Evergreen State College. She was a member of the International Solidarity Movement, and that's how she ended up in Gaza in the briefest of tellings. Can you tell us more about your daughter? When did Rachel first get interested in social justice? What was she like growing up?
That's a big question.
I know, right? I just thought we'd go right for the very broad.
Right. Well, Rachel was our third child. She spent her whole life here in Olympia, Washington, grew up here. Craig and I hail from the Midwest, but we landed in Olympia in 1975, and Rachel was born here in 1979. In a lot of ways, I think she was very much a product of the Northwest. She loved the setting here. We live just right outside of Olympia on a little stream. There's a salmon run. It's getting to be about that time of year when the salmon will run here. And so she was very, you know, tied to the environment, tied to nature. She, in terms of social justice, I remember right after she was killed, somebody asked me if she was always an activist, you know, and I said, no, she was just my kid.
Right.
And so I don't think as parents you think about your children in those terms very much. But then people started to remind us of things that, you know, had happened along the way. I think the one that most people are most familiar with is that when she was a fifth grader, she went to the public schools here in Olympia, but was part of, was in a program called the Options Program that still exists. And Craig and I were some of the founders with other teachers and community members of that program. And the idea was to look at the world as your community. It had a very much a global focus, and also to encourage kids not to think that they were getting ready for life, but to feel empowered that they could do something. And there's a video of Rachel when she was 10 years old as a fifth grader when her class studied world hunger. And they were here in the state capitol, so they went to the capitol after doing all this study. And she had crafted a speech that she gave on world hunger and presented it. And the media came to see what the kids were talking about, and actually brought attention to world hunger. So I think in some ways, that's probably one of the moments that people focus on as kind of a beginning. But you know, I think she just always had a very rich internal life. She was always sitting in the corner writing and drawing and observing and taking in a lot about the world.
And for those of you who have been living under a rock somewhere, we want to let the listeners know that we have to say that Rachel was, Rachel Corey was an activist, and she was.
We can just sort of unwrap the story from there.
Yeah.
That she started going to Evergreen State College and got involved with the International Solidarity Movement, Is that right?
Yeah. And I think it really sort of stemmed in terms of that out of 9/11. So she actually...
What's the connection there? Go ahead.
Well, you know, there was that horrendous attack on the World Trade Center and on our country. And in fact, Rachel was... We were living on the East Coast at the time, and Cindy and I were going to Boston, and Rachel was going to meet us there on September 12th. She was to fly. So originally she was kind of frustrated, as well as being frightened by all that, but frustrated with the fact that she couldn't fly anywhere. But I don't think that she believed our president's statement that they hated us because of our freedom. And she started to try to figure out, you know, what was going on in the world that would, what were the steps that led up to the attack on the World Trade Center. And certainly the situation in Israel-Palestine was part of that. You know, bin Laden, I don't know that it really was that much of it, but he certainly used it as a recruiting tool. And so she started to find out about that. And the more she read, the more interested she got into it. And she started to, I think, sort of leave hints with Cindy that she was interested in going there, more with Cindy than me. But, you know, she was 23 years old, and she wasn't really looking for permission to go. But like most kids trying to break something to their parents that they figure their parents weren't really going to like, she would hint at it a little bit. And Cindy actually went out, and we have connections in the family to India, and she thought, well, you know, she could maybe go to India instead. And she didn't really realize, we weren't living here in Olympia where Rachel was, so we didn't realize how much she'd found out about how she'd studied Arabic and, you know, really prepared herself to go there. So she was always focused on going to Palestine and, in fact, to the Gaza Strip and to Rafah in the Gaza Strip. And I think kind of going back to trying to look over her life, in a way, and it's much easier looking backwards than going forward.
Hindsight always is, yeah.
But I think more than really any other person that I know, Rachel would not allow herself to look away from marginalized people. So there's a poem that she wrote when she was 12 years old talking about homeless people and how that we would give them a dollar so we did not really have to look at them. And she was tuned into that in middle school. In early high school, she started working on a teen care line where teenagers could call in. And she transferred to the adult crisis clinic while she was still in high school. And then that led to a job that she had through college working with people with some mental illness in a hospital diversion house, so people that could stay outside of the hospital and work there. And, you know, so if you're thinking in terms of marginalized people, then there are few peoples in the world that are more marginalized than the Palestinians, and in that, inside Gaza, and completely down to Rafah. And so looking at sort of that string, mm-hmm. I think it's... maybe not inevitable, but you can see the steps that got her to that place.
And so she went on an international solidarity movement group. Was it a group trip, or was it her just in league with the ISM?
Rachel became familiar with the ISM when... friends of hers had gone actually the summer before in 2002. The International Solidarity Movement, it isn't an organization really or a group, it is a movement. And it was founded when in the United Nations there had been a resolution after 2000, after the beginning of the Second Intifada, to send a human rights monitoring force to the region. And that was vetoed by the United States supporting Israel. And when that happened, there were activists in Palestinian activists joined by Israeli Jewish activists and those in the United States to form this movement to actually call people to come to the region and to stand in solidarity with Palestinians who wanted to challenge the occupation, to challenge what was happening, but to do that through nonviolent means. And Friends of Rachel had traveled there in 2002. She started to do, she was already doing reading about it and so forth, but then she was, I think, really influenced by them. One of her friends had gone to Gaza. He told her that that was where the need was greatest. And so she then started to make her own plans to go there. She, did a lot of educating of herself and preparation. She didn't just decide one day to go.
Sure.
She did a lot of reading. She was educating me, even though I was in North Carolina. She was sending me books to read and materials to read. When I would come here to Olympia to visit, which I did in 2002 a couple of times, she'd check out films from the Evergreen Library, documentary films that we would watch together. And she, she'd talk to me, wonder what I thought about the whole thing. And so when she traveled, it's interesting that there were others from Olympia that were going at the same time. Two other friends of hers actually went, but they didn't really travel together. And they weren't always in the Gaza Strip together at the same time. When she arrived in the region, she traveled first to the West Bank, to a place south of Bethlehem called Beit Sahur. And at that time, that's where training for international solidarity movement people occurred. And she writes in her writing, she writes about, being inside with this group of internationals that had come from all over. And she talks about everybody sort of exchanging their theories, their political theories and so forth, and then being able to hear outside the military vehicles and the sirens and so forth. So it was an entrance into a world that I think interested her greatly. And then she came to just love the people, but it was completely a new experience and something she did quite independently.
I want to remind listeners, you are tuned to KBOO Portland, your community radio station, 90.7 FM or KBOO.FM if you're streaming online. I'm Ani. I'm here with Lynn, and we are talking this morning with Cindy and Craig Corey. They are the parents of Rachel Corey, and they're going to be in town with an after-play discussion on Sunday, and the play is called My Name is Rachel Corey. It's a play made about Rachel Corey, their daughter. And let's actually go ahead and talk a little about the play after I say you are more than welcome, dear listener, to join in this conversation by calling 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. We also invite you to stay in touch with us at Positively Revolting by liking us on Facebook. You can also contact us through email, writing to positivelyrevolting@gmail.com or in the Twitterverse at Positive Revolt.
And cover social media, I believe.
I think there's at least
Facebook?
Five or six
we have not
touched yet. But all in good time, good people. 503-231-8187. So the you're going to be in town on Sunday in conjunction with a performance of the play My Name is Rachel Corey. Just to give some details on that. The play will be Sunday evening at the First Unitarian Church.
From 7 to 9 p.m.
At the Elliott Hall.
Yep.
And
12th and Salmon here in Portlandia.
Indeed. And after the play is performed, there will be a discussion with you both, as well as the actress and the producer of the play for this particular performance. I want to, ask you about how the play came into being. So this is a piece of work that was written from Rachel's own diaries and letters. Is that correct? The words are actually in the play, are actually Rachel's words.
They are. They're, I think, a couple of emails from Cindy and from me and from one of her friends, Todd. But the rest of the words are Rachel's, and they're taken and edited by the British actor Alan Rickman and the British editor for The Guardian, Catherine Viner. So
those are two extremely heavy hitters. How did they become aware of Rachel's writings?
Well, as Cindy said, Rachel was making us aware of the situation in Gaza through her emails, and she had always wanted these to be, you know, she wanted word to get out, and so we knew she would have liked to have had some of this email or be asked to write for a different newspaper. So when she was killed, I think my cousin called in the first hour after Rachel was killed and talked to Cindy. And Cindy said, we've got to get her words out, because our family had been following this. And it was a narrative we didn't know. You know, growing up, Cindy read to the kids all the time. And she read about the Holocaust and about Jewish children, some like Anne Frank that did not survive and some that did. But that was a narrative we knew and sort of extrapolated to Israel. But we weren't familiar with the Palestinian narrative, and Rachel was teaching that to us. So as Rachel's brother said, when he read the emails, this is a perspective I've never seen before. So when she was killed... And
we should say, in a spectacular way, which also, just for our listeners need to know, we all know that she was run over by tanks.
A D9. It's actually very armored, so it doesn't look like what you see in Portland or in Olympia. But
not yet. We're getting there, though.
Yeah, they're built by Caterpillar and then armored. At that time, they were armored in Israel, and they were used to destroy homes for the most part, and they just go through the walls and stuff. So they're about 65-ton bulldozer. And Rachel and her friends on March 16th, to sort of take the story away from where we started and what happened to her, they were in Gaza, and they had their technique was to stay, particularly at night, they would stay with some of the families who were out close to the border, not the border with Israel, but the border with Egypt. And at that time, the Israeli military was destroying homes in this community. It was a city, so it's like being part of Portland. And they were just destroying the homes to make a buffer area along the border with Egypt. And so wholesale, these homes, and eventually during that time that Rachel was there, I think the homes of about 10% of the population of Rafah were destroyed there. So Rachel and her friends would stay at different houses that were right along the border and try to have a presence there that they hope would keep the military from destroying the houses if they had international observers, or at least they could document that.
Right.
So she'd stayed with the family, the Nasrallah family, which was two brothers, each of them who had a wife that they were living in this house, a duplex, and then the older brother had three children, and the younger brother at that time had two children. And so altogether, four adults and five children were behind the wall that Rachel stood in front of. And that day, when there were two bulldozers and an armored personnel carrier out there in the area, they were at times pushing on walls of structures that were partially destroyed, or I think there was some sort of tool shed out there that they're pushing on another wall. And then very late in the afternoon, both bulldozers and the armored personnel carrier sort of retreated toward the border area at around 5 o'clock. And what we know now by talking to people in the military and seeing their records is that the captain that was in charge of the mission on the ground was asking for permission to go back to his headquarters because the activists were in the area and he just wanted to give it up for the day and come back sometime when there weren't people there. But he was denied that permission and told in some language that we don't know the exact words to not let the activists stop them, but to go back in. And they took a run straight at the Nasrallah home, And Rachel stood in front of him, and while earlier in the day, if the activists stood in front of the bulldozers would come right up to their feet, but then stop and back off. This time, the bulldozer kept coming, and so it ran over her. She tried to climb to the top of the mound that it was pushing, and the activists say that she actually succeeded in doing that and was able to get her head above the blade, and so she was clearly visible. But the earth that was being moved got over her feet somehow, and so she tripped and was pushed under, and the bulldozer just kept coming. So the blade went over her, and then the bulldozer backed up, and she was actually alive for a few minutes after that, but we're told by the medics that got there that there was really no sign of life by the time they got there. So so that's kind of what happened to Rachel. And then that became instantly worldwide news. So our family really found out about it through through the media, you know, seeing it on our daughter saw it on TV after being warned by having a message from a friend saying she was so sorry about the tragedy that she saw it on TV. And
Whoa.
I had no idea. They turned on the TV and they could see Olympia Woman killed in Gaza, and then later that was changed to Rachel Corey, and then so our daughter called us, and that's how we found out about it. And in the hours after that, we just knew we wanted Rachel's words to get out. The Guardian newspaper was interested in doing an article on Rachel, and so the International Solidarity Movement got our permission to send all the emails that Cindy had gathered together to the Guardian. Then they were going to pick some quotes out of what Rachel had written, and we got an email back, I think, about 24 hours later from an editor and said that this is so personalizes the situation in Gaza that they had decided just to print the emails. And you can still go out to the Guardian's website for, I think it's March 18th, 2003, and they have a section they call Rachel's War. And all of the emails that were sent to Cindy were part of that. And I'd forgotten that we had one exchange with me that was on my computer. And so I sent that the next day, and they published it the following day, which was actually our last communication with Rachel is what I sent. So the Guardian newspaper ran this, and a friend of Alan Rickman's read it, and she gave the article to Alan, said, you should look at this. And Alan works with the Royal Court Theater, and he took that writing to the Royal Court Theater and said, we should maybe try to do some sort of workshop with this. So the Royal Court Theater wrote to us and wanting permission to work with those words for a workshop. And we were, distracted. Cindy's sisters took that email, answered it, and kind of checked out
if you can't trust the Royal Court, who can you trust?
Yeah, well, we didn't know.
Sure, I know.
Sister from Ashland, Oregon, goes right to some friends down there, and you find out, no, the Royal Court Theater is the place in the world where they, in the English world, where they really bring up new playwrights and stuff. And so it is the place to have it. And so then we really didn't do anything on it until about 6 months after Rachel was killed. We went to Gaza, and on the way back, we stopped in London. A British young man was injured in Gaza, and Tom Herndl, and he later died of his wounds. He was shot in the head by the Israeli military, and that happened. There were actually three internationals killed along that border about 2 mile distance in 7 weeks, and Tom was the second. So we had met his family over the telephone, and we stopped in London to meet him in person. And so while we were there, we met with the Royal Court Theater and gave them permission to put the words together.
Yeah, so it's so interesting that this has just been a spiral of of events. And, of course, Rachel ends up meaning so much to so many people and affecting things, not the way she was planning, I'm sure, when she went to Palestine, but you never know how that's going to happen. But you also took these enormous lemons and turned them into a foundation, the Rachel Corrie Foundation, which also... there's another woman, I was reading about this, Linda Beale, whose daughter was Amy, was also brutally killed as she registered voters for the first election in which South Africans could participate. Could you kind of give us a little background on that?
When Rachel was killed, Craig and I were living in South Carolina, but our home was really here in Olympia, and our daughter Sarah was living in our house here with her husband. And we came here, and there was a memorial for Rachel, and this was where her community was, as well as many long-term friends of ours. And, of course, our lives were so dramatically changed by what happened that day. And quite quickly, you know, we were receiving communications from everywhere, but a woman in Seattle who had worked with Linda Beale and connected with friends here in Olympia and let us know that Linda Beale was going to be at the University of Washington. And as you said, the Beale family's daughter, Amy, had been killed in South Africa in a really brutal killing when she was there to register people for the black South Africans for the first election. She was mistaken for being Afrikaner. She was pulled from a car and killed. And her family's response to that was to do what they thought Amy would want. And they became they were part of the truth and reconciliation process. I've actually seen Linda Beale on television with one of the people who killed her daughter. I think there were four people involved. But there were at least two of those people that were in the truth and reconciliation process. And they talked about, they explained what had brought them to a point where they could do something like they did. And Amy and the Beals themselves testified about what it meant to lose their daughter in such a way. But we had the privilege of traveling to the University of Washington 2 weeks, I think, after Rachel was killed, and to meet with Linda and to hear their story. And I remember having coffee with her after the talk at the University of Washington, and I asked her if she'd ever been able to reclaim her life, the life she had had before Amy was killed. And she took quite a while to respond, but then she looked at me and said, "Not really." And my daughter Sarah was with us, and she said she knew that that meant game over, that we were going yeah. in a different direction. And the Beals had started a foundation in South Africa, and they actually eventually worked with some of the people that were involved in their daughter's killing. And they had a bakery there and so forth. I don't know the status of it now. But that story influenced us a great deal. People were coming to us, some, you know, sending donations and that kind of thing. And we thought, what do we do with this? And hearing that story prompted us to think, well, there's probably room for some kind of an organization based on or drawing inspiration from what Rachel wanted to do. And so we founded eventually the Rachel Corrie Foundation for Peace and Justice, and we're here in Olympia.
That's fantastic. Let's go ahead and see. I believe we have Jake on the line. Good morning, Jake.
Good morning.
Go ahead with your questions or comments.
Yeah. I thank you guys so much for sharing your story. I have an 8-month-old daughter at home who is just, you know, amazing at 8 months old. And when I hear you tell the story of your daughter, you know, her courage and compassion and all that, it just inspires me to want to raise my daughter in that way. Sorry, I'm really emotional about it. But at the same time, it scares the hell out of me, you know?
Sure.
Because obviously with the tragedy and saying, you know, when you raise a daughter to be that way, you know, I want her to be adventurous and courageous and to go out into the world and fight for justice for others, but, you know, how do we kind of, there's not, I know that you didn't raise your daughter to die in that way, but you raised her to be courageous and compassionate, you know. I don't know what the question is, but kind of how do you parse out the fear as well as the hope, you know?
I'm not
Are you sure asking, Jake, are you asking for advice as to how you can deal with this with your daughter, or?
No, just kind of, you know, being inspired by the story as well as
so maybe it's just a comment.
You know, kind of the tension of how do I raise a daughter to be compassionate? You know, what did you do to do that? As well as, you know, how do you, I'm sure that there were moments like you were talking about when she was talking about going to Palestine and you were like, you know, she kind of kept us from it because she probably knew we would have tried to get her to go somewhere else. You know, at what point do you just, I don't know. I just wanted to say thank you for the story. It inspires me, but I have to be honest that it also scares me.
I just was reminded when you were speaking about a poem by Khalil Gibran and on children, and I refer to it fairly often. I did after Rachel was killed, and I would encourage all of you to read it, any parent to read it, because he begins by saying, your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you. And though they are with you, yet they belong not to you. And I think it's, he just so beautifully, I think, shares what I always knew intellectually as a parent and what I believed in and how I tried to view my parenting. I think you're, I can tell by the tone of your voice, you're doing all the right things and you want all of the best for your child. And you certainly want her to be safe forever. We all want that. Craig and I wish that Rachel was here. But we have a responsibility and a duty, you know, to give our children the very best beginnings that we can, and other children too, not just our own. And then to let them forge their path, and sometimes it goes in sad directions. But for the most part, then our children go out and they lead the way for all of us, which is exactly what Rachel did.
Yeah, well, just thank you so much for the inspiration, and you know. I hear every time I hear stories, I'm hearing stories like your daughter, and then also hearing stories of what's happening to Palestinian children. I can't help but imagine it happening to my own, which is why I'm, you know, it terrifies me. But at the same time, you know, the compassion and the love and the stories of bravery and courage that I hear from you are also inspiring. And that's where the tension is, I guess. But thank you so much for sharing that story. It's really empowering and inspiring.
Thanks for your call, Jake.
Thank you.
It's about 20 minutes till 9 o'clock in the morning. You are listening to Positively Revolting here on KABU, your community radio station. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And you can follow along with Positively Revolting throughout the week by liking us on Facebook. You can also email us at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. You can, we're also there in the Twitterverse, Positive Revolt. And with that, we are this morning fortunate to be talking with Cindy and Craig Corey, Rachel Corey's parents. We're discussing the life of Rachel Corey, her work, and the play written from her words, a play based on diaries and emails called My Name is Rachel Corey. And that play is going to be performed Sunday night here in Portland at the First Unitarian Church. That is at 12th and Salmon downtown, and that's going to be at the Elliott Chapel, and with a discussion following the play with Cindy and Craig. So you know, I think it is an incredible journey, really, to turn grief, you know, the profound grief over the loss of your daughter into carrying on her work. and making this foundation and making sure that her work does live on and that people understand the severity of the issues involved when we're looking at Palestine and the Gaza Strip. And it's one of those issues that so often when somebody starts to say that they are advocating for the rights of Palestinians, we often hear immediate accusations of, well, then you're anti-Semitic. And I know that the play itself has had sometimes some difficulty being performed because people have accused the play of being anti-Semitic. Can you respond to that?
Well, I think when we hear that, the kind of the first thing we ask is if the people accusing the play of that have read the play or seen the play.
Good start. Very good start, Greg.
Because usually the answer is no. And because I just don't think, I don't think it is. And what one of the things I want to say for people who are thinking about coming to play, and I really urge you to do it, we've seen Ashley Molloy, the actress, do at least excerpts of the play a couple of times. She's a very good actress, and I think that that this is a good version of the play to see. But the other thing is the play is funny, so and you wouldn't expect that. So it's not quite as harsh an evening as you might be thinking it would be to come see the play. It actually has a lot to do with Rachel's life before she went to Gaza and a lot to do with Rachel. So that being said, I really think that equating a criticism of the actions of the government Israel with being anti-Semitic, it's pretty obviously you shouldn't do that. It's wrong, but it's also dangerous because when people realize what's going on in Gaza, and if they think that that's what all Jews want, it's liable to actually encourage people to be anti-Semitic. We have a whole lot of Jewish friends, and many of whom live in or have lived in Israel, who are very much against the occupation and against what's going on there. So, and you know, when I look at this issue, I think that Rachel was killed by a military, but she was held when she died by a Jew, Alice. And you know, there wasn't. She would have been the most critical of herself to try to ferret out those feelings if they were there. And I just never saw that in Rachel at all. And I don't see it in the play. I think the play is honest. It comes directly from Rachel and what Rachel saw, and she was in Gaza. She wasn't in Tel Aviv. So, you know, it is telling the story from the author's point of view, but that's valid of every piece of art. I think that's what makes, you know, that's part of a coherency there. So I don't think that's a reason for a criticism. But it's a valid point of view. It's factual. It's she saw those things, and it also shows her reaction to what she saw. And I think it's you know, I encourage people to come out and see it with an open mind and incorporate that into their understanding of what was going on and is going on in the Gaza Strip.
I would just add that while yes. There have been occasions where there has been that criticism of the play, and actually it's, I think, less a criticism than it is a diversionary tactic, an approach by some who feel, who come from a different perspective and feel threatened by the discussion, I think, that the play and that Rachel's story has generated. And look for ways to stop that from happening. And that's certainly what happened. It happened initially when the play was to come to New York City. But that has been really just such a small bit of the history of what happened. I understand that this came up in Portland, too, so I know we'll have more opportunity to talk about that. But the play, Craig always says it's been on every continent except Antarctica. We've seen it. We counted. We've seen it in six languages. one of the most recent performances of it was in Hebrew, and that was in Yaffa, near Tel Aviv, in an Arab Hebrew theater. We were in Israel in May and June for a Supreme Court hearing in Rachel's case, when our friends, and these are Jewish Israeli friends, and people that we actually hadn't met before. They had done the play the year before. When they found out that we were coming, they wanted to do a performance of the play in solidarity with us. And so we saw a packed house in very near Tel Aviv, performed by a Jewish Israeli actress, directed by Jewish Israeli director from Haifa, and the audience was primarily an audience full of Jewish Israeli activists. So, you know, they were there to support us and to bring this version of the play to us. And it was a wonderful evening. There was a reporter there from Israeli Army Radio, a young person. They covered these stories. And, you know, one thing, there are a lot of issues and so much sadness with what's going on there now, but sometimes I think the discussion about things happens more easily there than it has happened historically here in the United States. So
harder to avoid there. It just seems, if you were there, I mean, you have been there, so I can ask you. It seems it's because people are in the middle of it, what you know, you have to talk about it.
Uh-huh.
Wouldn't you think? Or does that seem that way when you're there?
Well, I think also, I mean, our Israeli friends and Palestinian friends really pride themselves on discussion. And one thing I notice, too, about when I go to their newspapers, the articles and everything are much more extensive and longer. There's a lot of discussion. And, of course, there are a lot of different points of view, but they do find expression there. So,
beyond sound bites.
Yeah, beyond sound bites. And this topic, I think we're in a much better place in terms of discussion and in terms of people seeing the full picture than we were almost 12 years ago when Rachel was killed. There were things then, there was language then that we couldn't possibly have felt comfortable talking about because people here would react so strongly. Use of the word apartheid. Jimmy Carter, you know, wrote his book, and that was well after Rachel was killed, calling for peace, not apartheid. And, you know, so the discourse has changed, is changing, but it's still difficult. But I just want to again say that the accusation of anti-Semitism, I think, is completely unfounded about the play, but is also more of a tactic to divert people from it than it is accurate.
That seems a fair statement to me. It is about 10 minutes till 9 o'clock in the morning. If you have a question or comment, please do give us a call right now, as there's no time to waste. 503-231-8187 is the number here to get through to the KABU Air Room for your question or comment. We are talking with Cindy and Craig Corey, parents of Rachel Corey, murdered activist who was doing solidarity work in the Gaza Strip, murdered in 2003. You, Cindy, had just mentioned that you were in Tel Aviv for a Supreme Court, for a round of Supreme Court case regarding Rachel's death. Can you tell us about that?
When Rachel was killed, we worked or immediately turned really to the U.S. government for help, most immediately to our Congressman Brian Baird. And we waited, you know, to see what would happen. Immediately after Rachel was killed, President Bush, we understand, spoke with Prime Minister Sharon. He was promised a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation in her case. And so we waited for that to occur. And as did people at the Department of State and the American Embassy. within a couple of months, we had word that that the investigation was complete, that it was closed, that no charges would be brought, and that the report that had been promised to President Bush at least would not be sent physically to our government. It was not released. And then, you know, we waited again for some more response from the U.S. government. And we had conversations with people at the State Department and so forth. And we were eventually able to read the report at the Israeli consulate in San Francisco. In 2004, we received a letter from Colin Powell's chief of staff in which he said he could answer our question unequivocally that the report that they had seen did not reflect an investigation that was thorough, credible, and transparent. And it's remained the position of the U.S. government that investigation in Rachel's case was not adequate. Also, the U.S. basically told us there was not a great deal more that they could do, although they did then and they continue through the present administration to ask questions about Rachel's case. That prompted us, and because we were also facing statutes of limitation, to determine that we would move ahead legally. And because there had been a military investigation, we could only do that through a civil case, through a civil lawsuit. So in 2005, right before we were going to lose the opportunity to do that, we filed a civil lawsuit. And it took a very long time, but finally, for a lot of reasons, but finally testimony started in Haifa District Court in 2010. It ended in 2011, and in 2012, the single judge who heard the case found completely for the Israeli military. There are no juries in Israel, so it was one judge. The beauty of, I think, what we did is that we were actually able to bring to the court, even though we couldn't see them. They had screens so that we were not able, because of a security certificate, not able to see most of the soldiers who were on the ground, including the driver of the bulldozer and the commander who was sitting next to him in the bulldozer. But we could hear them and hear from them, and also from some of the higher-level military officials. And it's very rare for military to be charged in a case that involves or it's connected to the Palestinians. And so I think it's been an opportunity. It's exposed some things, some of which are pretty difficult and painful, the viewpoints that we've heard. But the judge found completely for the military. We appealed that decision, and there was a one-day court hearing this May in Israeli Supreme Court. There are only certain pieces of the decision that we can actually address, but we're now waiting for a decision from the Israeli Supreme Court.
Well, good luck with that for the world. I hope for that. I have always admired you two for the way your clarity and how. I know you've had the foundation, what you do with your grief, that you can speak about this so well. Was that really, I guess I want to thank you for that. It's always inspirational to see what people do with grief. It's such an interesting, it never goes away, but to to use it the way you have, I admire and thank you very much.
Thank you. And I just wanted to mention that we were involved in a lawsuit against Caterpillar Corporation, not because something bad happened with a piece of Caterpillar machinery, but because Caterpillar was on notice. Hundreds, thousands of people have written and communicated with them and continue to communicate with them about how their equipment is being used to commit human rights violations in the Middle East. and yet they continue to service the equipment, they continue to sell the equipment, and so forth. And one of our attorneys in that Caterpillar lawsuit, which also was serving four Palestinian families whose family members had been killed when houses were demolished on top of them, mm-hmm. killed or injured,
right.
One of the attorneys is a resident of Portland. Her name is Gwen Skinner. She works at Willamette Law School, and she will also be at the play on the panel on Sunday evening. So I just wanted to mention
excellent.
This would be an opportunity for people to hear from someone who's truly an expert on all of this a bit more about it.
And again, this Sunday, there is a performance of My Name is Rachel Corey. It's the play based on Rachel Corey's own words from her diaries, from her letters, edited and pulled together by Alan Rickman.
So you got to see it. It's Alan Rickman.
Who I have to say is possibly my favorite actor. It's true. But that's a whole different thing.
He's a very nice man.
Yeah, very nice. Yeah, you wouldn't believe
I'm
it.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Thank you. We like hearing that this morning. Then
it's going to do wonders for anyway. I do want to thank you for being with us this morning and spending your last hour with us discussing both Rachel's life, her work, the situation of the Palestinian people, and this play coming up Sunday night, 7 to 9 o'clock at the First Unitarian Church. In Portland, KABU is a very proud co-sponsor of that performance, and it is following the performance, there will be time for discussion with Cindy and Craig so we can continue this conversation.
And if you want to keep up on what they're doing, there is the Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice online. It's got all kinds of great information and a really great picture of Cindy dressed as a dove.
We have just about a minute left. Is there anything else you would like to add, Craig or Cindy?
Well, I thank you for this chance to discuss things, and I do encourage people to come to the play, and I do try to get out that actually it's enjoyable. It's not it's funny, and it's about a young woman, and I think it gives some idea, you know, as we were talking to Jake about a young woman growing up, and certainly it's from Rachel's point of view, not from her father's. But I think people will enjoy the evening as well as learn something. And so I hope that we can see people Sunday night.
And I would just add that we have friends right now in Gaza from the Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility Group, and the people there are continuing to suffer. I think it's important for us all to remember that even when the worst of the bombing and the fighting stops, it goes on for people there. And this is just in another way for us to stay connected and to think about what we can do.
Excellent way to end things. Thank you so much for
being with us. And we'll see you Sunday.
And Greg Corey, yes.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
There comes a time.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, presented by the Northwest Film Center. While cinema provides entertainment and escape,